I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Washington, D.C. is seeing a jobs boon this week for snowplow drivers, utility workers, or kids with snow shovels. The nation's capital is still digging out from 2 feet of snow from the weekend. Another foot or two are expected tomorrow. But that will eventually melt. Will the fierce partisan divide? President Obama met with leaders of Congress today to push his jobs bill. Gail Shattuck is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's been following all of this. And Gail, besides being fed up with snow, is there anything Democrats and Republicans can agree on? And could a jobs bill be it?
Well, if there is anything, it is clearly the jobs bill. No one wants to look like they voted against jobs. And there are issues on which there is solid and genuine agreement. But Republicans are holding out, first and foremost, for a jobs bill in the form of tax cuts. So anything the president says that looks like tax breaks, all to the good. And I think that's something they can get some movement on. But I think they're going to hold out for other things that Democrats do not want to move on. For example, permanently freezing the estate tax at zero, which it is this year. Democrats do not want to do that. I think that Republicans could really hold out for that.
And just remind us a little bit, Phil, watercolor that in a little bit, the estate tax.
Well, this is something that President Bush in 2001 started to phase out. And in true Washington fashion, it phased out gradually and entirely this year. And then next year it comes back in force at 55% for the top level. Republicans want to get rid of that.
Yeah, and this is people having to pay a tax on inherited estates.
Exactly right.
Well, just talk a little bit more about why jobs are so important. The unemployment rate now 9.7%. higher in some parts of the country. Republicans pointed out last year the president and Democratic leader said the stimulus bill would keep unemployment from topping 8%, and here we are. But Democrats have been saying that, you know, jobs are always the last thing to come in a recovering economy.
That's right.
So tell us more about, you know, that debate.
Well, I think Democrats are very concerned that they will come into the 2010 election with nothing to show for what they've done. If you invested everything in jobs and it was slow to come back, what do you have to run on? They also are convinced that the only way to get something big and dramatic through is early, which is why they've invested so much in health care and which was why they're trying to revive it at this point. They need something to show for unified control, the White House, the House, the Senate, and for a chunk of that, the 60 votes in the Senate to move legislation,
right,
and to have nothing to show for it is inconceivable.
Well, and that's why perhaps the president this weekend proposed a half-day summit on February 25th. It's going to be broadcast live on television, Democrats and Republicans presenting their ideas. Republicans say they want to start from scratch. The president says that's not going to happen. So your thoughts on this meeting on what February 25th?
I think Republicans are realizing that this could actually be bad for them. They're looking back at the encounter that the president had with House Republicans a couple weeks back, and he did very well. I mean, it was Americans' first chance to look at something like Prime Minister Question Hour in the parliamentary system, where the president, who of course has a higher pulpit, higher platform, bats away questions from the loyal opposition. And I think they're concerned that what this will turn into is time for Democrats to come together, the House and the Senate, on a health plan they can agree on, and a public venue that could make them look obstructionist and bad.
Yeah. Well, yesterday we want to touch on sad news in Washington. Democrats shocked by the loss of Congressman John Murtha of Pennsylvania, died at 77 after complications from gallbladder surgery. Just, you know, how his loss will be, is being felt in Congress?
Murtha is, you know, one of the last bastions, believe it or not, of bipartisanship. He is the lead appropriator for defense appropriations. He has control of a great deal of money. He works with Republicans. He works with Democrats. He holds out for the that old earmark system that's come under such assault. But his view is you do what you can for your district, and that's critically important. He does it for his district, and he helps other lawmakers do it for theirs. In a way, he's an old-style, old-generation politician, a protege of Tip O'Neill, a very close confidant of Nancy Pelosi. And, frankly, just loved.
Yeah. Well, he is being missed today, but also missed is that, you know, that reaching across the divide. We started talking about the snow, serious topic there, 230,000 federal workers getting another day off. But just in the few seconds we have, and just a couple seconds, how is this, shutting down the Capitol?
Well, they claim they're going to go ahead with votes, but, you know, members are having a great deal of difficulty getting back here, and the fact that we're heading into another storm. And frankly, the Capitol has not done well with this one. The roads, even main arteries, are often impassable. Major avenues heading into the city you can't get by on.
So the normal gridlock is even worse today.
Yes, Mother Nature has contributed to the normal gridlock, yes.
Gail Chad, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we've reported that endowments at major universities have dropped by as much as a quarter in the last couple of years, and private donations to universities are down by almost $4 billion. Well, our guest today, Columbia sociologist Jonathan Cole, says that adds to the threats that universities face, which include government regulation after 9/11 and sometimes the lack of internal debates over ideas. Jonathan Cole served as provost and dean at Columbia for 14 years. His new book is The Great American University, Its Rise to Preeminence, Its Indispensable National Role, and Why It Must Be Protected. He's also written an article on the subject in the Chronicle of Higher Education. We'll link you at our website, hereandnow.org. And full disclosure, Professor Cole is also a trustee of Boston University, which holds the license of our home station, WBUR. So, Professor, welcome, and let's talk about how you see the 125 or so research universities, in particular, in the U.S. under threat. But first, you say they're indispensable because of what they produce. So give us some examples.
They've produced fetal monitoring, DNA fingerprinting, scores and scores of antibiotics, the Heimlich maneuver, and the basis for new nanotechnology. They have been at the forefront of dealing with cancer and cancer research. They have been the source of the origin of computers and computer software, email, the internet. The creation of artificial limbs.
Not to mention Guitar Hero. Graduates of MIT were behind the company Harmonix, which created Guitar Hero and, of course, Beatles Rock Band. And that's not insignificant. I mention it because you tell us how MIT, for instance, how many companies can MIT say are related to students or faculty? And how much money does that generate?
MIT reported that 4,000 MIT-related companies employed over 1.1 million people that had annual worldwide sales of well over $230 billion, which would make MIT companies among the 40 largest economies in the world.
And this idea of producing ideas is by design. American universities were built, you write, as a hybrid of English and German institutions in the early 1900s. And then later, it was a strategy to have universities get tax dollar money to create innovation rather than have all innovation come out of government-controlled labs. So explain to us, what does that mean, a hybrid of English and German institutions?
Education until the end of the 19th century was largely that of undergraduates and preparing people for the ministry. It wasn't really dedicated or focused on how to produce new knowledge. That new knowledge component and how to do it came out of the German university system, put together with the undergraduate offerings and structure of the British university system. Out of that came the American model of education, where professors and students really worked collaboratively in laboratories, particularly in research laboratories, whereas in the German research model, it was much more of the professor working as an overseer of the work of individual students, where individual students had very little to say in what was going on.
And in the U.S., they can be on a first-name basis. But, you know, let's get to your thesis that these universities are now under attack because, as you well know, especially in the New England area where we're, you know, silly with universities, there are a lot of people who feel they're under attack from the university. There are neighborhoods protesting expansions and people who don't want bio labs in their backyard. But you are concentrating on how you feel universities are under attack internally and externally. Start with the internally. How do you see that?
The first one that we should mention is financial attack, particularly the public universities like the University of California system, which is one of the great systems of higher education in the world. Berkeley, UCLA, San Diego are three of the top 20 universities in the world. By financially strangling these institutions, by cutting their budgets, they are making them essentially non-competitive, and they are really in the process of dismantling the California system. But it's not only California. It's places like Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona.
I just want to stay with that for 1 second, because as you won't know, just let's address what some might say is what the universities did to themselves. There are critics of universities who say they taught the economics and political science that led to the financial collapse. And not only that, they put all their apples in that basket. And so places like Harvard, they've had their endowments plummet because they not only taught it, they believed it. So that some of this financial damage is self-inflicted.
Well, I think that to some extent, the work that's gone on in universities has have led to some of the unfortunate consequences of the fiscal crisis of 2008. But I think the universities are probably the least to blame for that crisis. It's not that the universities aren't without responsibility to some extent in terms of their discoveries. But the fact is that I think the great outcome of these universities is far outweighs any harm that you could possibly think has come from the discoveries.
Well, you do point to other internal threats, and by that I mean within this country.
Yep.
And many of them are political. You say, for instance, that brilliant students were denied entry into the U.S. because they were from places the Bush administration in particular didn't like, and that politics also, we know, made its way into the sciences, when NASA, for instance, tried to censor the papers of James Hansen, the world's most distinguished climate scientist.
Yeah. Well, I think that this is true. We have lived through 8 years in which policies put in place by the Bush administration, particularly the USA Patriot Act and the Bioterrorism Defense Act, had very adverse consequences for universities. There were very strong restrictions on visas. Students who might have come from places like Iran or Middle Eastern countries were not even allowed in laboratories that were doing research on select agents, regardless of whether there was a scintilla of evidence that they were security threats. Now, the people who ran those labs were actually at risk of criminal indictments if they allowed a student from those countries to even step foot in their labs. Robert Richardson at Cornell, who was a Nobel Prize winner, said that after the passage of these acts, that when there were 38 people working with select agents trying to find cures for certain kinds of diseases like Ebola viruses or plague, that after these restrictions, only two researchers at Cornell continue to do immunological research on these very important problems. So the government basically has destroyed the laboratory work of some of our most creative scientists in the country.
Well, some would say those restrictions are a good thing. That's Jonathan Cole, a sociologist at Columbia University, talking about threats universities face. We want to ask him about that when we come back, and we will in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with sociologist Jonathan Cole, whose new book on what he sees as internal and external threats against America's research universities is called The Great American University. And before the break, Professor Cole was talking about government restrictions on foreign students in science labs working with materials like viruses that could be turned into weapons, and outright bans on other students coming to the U.S. But, Professor, then there's the case of Afia Siddiqui, the Pakistani-born woman who studied at MIT and Brandeis University and was just convicted of attempting to kill Americans in Afghanistan. Some would say that makes it wise to bar some students.
Prohibiting people, regardless of whether there is any evidence that they are in fact a security threat, simply shuts down the effectiveness of the laboratories and reduces the productivity of the laboratories. and the movement towards the discoveries that might, in fact, be antidotes to the things that bioterrorists would try to do to the country. We have to recognize that we are very dependent upon the talent from abroad. They are the basis for a lot of the technological and scientific advances that we're making because we are not producing enough young scientists and engineers within our own secondary educational system and college system.
Well, meanwhile, you point out many foreign students are coming here because they can freely exchange ideas. Now, you were invited by the Chinese to help them develop a research university. You say they aren't a competitive threat yet, but they may be down the road. And we wondered, what did Chinese officials say to you about that American way of thinking, the free and open exchange of ideas?
The Chinese government, at least the people that I dealt with, certainly genuflected to that idea that they would allow free inquiry and that they were not against people moving in their own directions. The real question is, what would happen if scientists came up with results that conflicted with the general political policies and ideology of the state? And it's not clear what would happen to that. And I think that uncertainty leads many Chinese who love their country, who would like to go home, to stay in the United States where they have extraordinary positions here.
This idea that American universities were created specifically to have this free exchange of ideas has led to so many other innovations. You talk about things like think tanks and, you know, things that we take for granted but were born in universities. And I just want to ask you if you think that that's still true, because as you're well aware, conservatives would say it's not. Studies show that most professors at leading universities are liberal, vote Democratic, and conservatives increasingly say that universities have become locked in a groupthink, which in a funny way, according to conservatives, boxes them in, keeps them from their original mandate of free thought. Your thoughts on that?
You know, most of the conservatives that have been trying to promote supposed balance in the curriculum of American universities in recent years, for example, organizations like Campus Watch, in fact, are ideologically committed not to balance, but to a particular point of view themselves. They just don't agree with what they perceive to be a liberal bias in these universities. And it is true, by the way, that the majority of faculty members at the great universities are self-identified as liberals and independents. But that doesn't mean that they don't provide balance in their classroom. It doesn't mean that they don't provide alternative points of view. And it doesn't mean that there aren't conservative modes of thinking within universities. I mean, take the University of Chicago's economics department. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a clash of perspectives. It may be that it comes from people at different universities.
Well, the stories that make the headlines are the ones that the conservatives point to. And at your own university, Columbia, Professor Joseph Massad, who teaches modern Arab politics, his scholarship reviewed very favorably by peers, but he was said to bully students who didn't share his pro-Palestinian views. You have Larry Summers, invited to University of California, former president of Harvard before being in the Obama administration and the Clinton administration. The invitation for him to speak at the University of California was rescinded after female faculty protested because of his comments about women in science. And then you have Jim Gilchrist, the founder of the Minutemen, the people who have taken it on themselves to protect the borders. He was unable to speak at Columbia because of hecklers.
And this is one of the threats to universities. For me, the great universities are willing to engage in conversations and dialogues about even the most radical ideas. But those radical ideas must be met with extraordinarily conservative ideas about the criteria for finding truth and fact. That essential tension in the university between willingness to engage in conversation about virtually anything, but the absolute demanding of very good evidence to demonstrate fact and truth is essential for the universities. And I do believe that within the universities, there tends to be, on the left and on the right, a tendency to not listen to alternative points of view.
You also cite as a threat to the university what former Harvard President Derek Bach writes about in his book, Universities in the Marketplace. He worries that the rush to patent scientific discoveries is discouraging universities from sharing information because they want to be the one. I mean, we talked about what economic engines they can be, so they want to own the ideas and the companies that come from that.
In 1980, the Bayh-Dole Act was intended to increase the transmission of knowledge from universities to industry and to speed that up. And that led to the ownership of intellectual property by universities, at least the intellectual property that came out of government-sponsored research. But the risk of this is that universities could potentially sell their souls to the devil. And what I mean by that is that if we don't control commercialization of ideas, if we don't have strict rules about conflict of interest, whether they are medical doctors who are working with pharmaceutical companies or whether they're doctors who are using their own knowledge to start up companies and use students to work on projects that are the potentially most lucrative as opposed to that which are the most fundamental, then I think universities are at risk of undermining their core values.
Jonathan Cole, social scientist at Columbia University, where for 14 years he was also a provost and dean. His new book is The Great American University, Its Rise to Preeminence, Its Indispensable National Role, and Why It Must Be Protected. Professor Cole, thanks so much for speaking to us about all of this.
It's a pleasure to be with you today, Robin.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow in Here and Now, as we said, the president is talking about a jobs bill. A journalist who covers manufacturing says, what about factory jobs? That's tomorrow. Still ahead, author Amy Bloom on love, not your traditional Hallmark card approach. The latest news is next, Here and Now. Advances in DNA technology over the past few years have had a dramatic effect on the way criminal investigations are conducted. The technology is also helping the people of Argentina find out what happened to some of the estimated 30,000 mostly young people said to have been killed by the military government, which ruled in the late 70s and early 80s. The Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team, a human rights organization, has launched a new public campaign asking families for blood samples to help them identify victims, known as the disappeared. The BBC's Candice Piet reports from Buenos Aires.
In a rundown building in Buenos Aires, I stepped into Argentina's troubled past. The Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team has been identifying the bones of the disappeared for almost a quarter of a century here.
So we've just come into the storage room, and it's filled to the ceiling with cardboard boxes, each one with identification labels on it. And how many people have you here?
Well, in this particular room, around 150, but we have like five rooms like this, full of these boxes where the skeletons are kept until we identify them and we receive authorization from the tribunal to give back them to each family.
It's been painstaking work for Luis Fondebrida and his team, but advances in DNA technology are speeding things up. 86 skeletons have been identified in the last 2 years after a publicity campaign asking families to provide DNA material. Last year, they announced they'd found Laura Feldman. As Luis explains, she was an 18-year-old left-wing militant who was killed in 1978.
When we exhumed the body, we were not very clear to whom we could belong. So with this public campaign, Laura's family provided blood samples. So when we set the samples to analyze in a lab outside Argentina with the capacity to process a large amount of samples in a short time, and together with the skeleton we exhumed in 2003, the results come out. So we have the possibility to confirm the identification of Laura. In that way, we were able to give a concrete response to Laura's family.
Para la cara, porque les
por los dientes. Ellos necesitaban la cara
sí,
y los dientes.
Sí.
Por el tema del reconocimiento.
Laura's sister, Anna Feldman, was 20 when Laura disappeared. She's finally received the death certificate she's been waiting for.
Saber la historia, digamos, tener una idea de cómo terminó.
To know the history, how it ended, put a full stop to something. Disappearance is this terrible thing. You don't know what happened. There is no data. There are families who had no information. We had just a little. But now I know what did happen, when it happened and how. I still need to know who did it, but the rest of it, I know.
A bright middle-class girl, Laura's father was a film director, her mother a journalist. She was a committed student activist. By the time she was picked up by the authorities, she was a member of the violent left-wing guerrilla group, the Montoneros, waging urban war on the military government. She was taken to one of Buenos Aires' clandestine detention centres.
This center was in a middle-class residential neighborhood. The people next door complained about the screaming. The guide shows us one of the cells. Laura was tortured for a month in a center like this one. She was shot, her body dumped in a grave in a cemetery along with four others. Anna remembers Laura now through the photographs she's kept and which she spreads out on the table to show me. The advances in forensic science mean that Anna does now have some sort of resolution. For Laura's mother, they came too late. She died before Laura's bones could be identified.
The BBC's Candice Piat, reporting from Buenos Aires. Well, coming up, a Philadelphia school district wrestles with accusations of civil rights violations after attacks between blacks and Asian students. We'll have that story in about 30 seconds, here and now. The Philadelphia School District is expected to release a report soon about a series of attacks that took place on December 3rd at South Philadelphia High School. Asian students were reportedly targeted by primarily African American students. The Asian kids say it was the culmination of bullying by blacks. Black students say it was just the actions of a few known bullies. Now the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund has filed a complaint with the Justice Department. Jeff Gamage is staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Jeff, we know 70% of students at the school are African American. About 10 to 15% are of Asian descent. What's your understanding of what happened on December 3rd?
On December 3rd, you have a situation where about 30 Asian students are attacked by groups of mostly African-American students, both inside and outside the school. There are 11 kids that are injured and require treatment at local hospitals. The most severely injured child, his nose was broken so severely that he needed surgery. And what followed from that was a boycott by about 50 Asian students who were afraid to go back to school, and the school district also suspended 10 students.
Okay, a couple questions. First of all, we read in the Associated Press that Superintendent Arlene Ackerman and other officials initially said the assault followed an attack on a disabled black student by two Asian students the day before. So is there a sense that this was revenge, or is there more of a one-way bullying pattern that goes back behind December 3rd?
It's unclear. The school district says there was a disabled African-American student who was specifically beaten up by Asian students outside the school on December 2nd. At the same time, it's also true that Asian advocates had been in touch with the school district for months saying that children were being injured and they were frightened and that something had to be done.
Well, we've reported on bullying here recently, in fact, and every expert says once kids get up the nerve to tell someone, they have to be protected by the school. So the Asian students who claim that this was ongoing bullying, had they told anybody? What did the school do?
Well, they had definitely told people about it, and advocates within the Asian community were talking with school officials since the end of last year, and the answer is that nothing really happened, and it wasn't until the December 3rd violence that people in officialdom really started paying attention.
Well, on the day of the attack, the principal reportedly walked some of the Asian students out of school, but Asian advocates say she didn't go far enough?
There's an allegation in the federal civil rights complaint that was filed by the Asian community that says Principal LaGretta Brown told these students that if they were afraid, she would walk with them, and that she then proceeded about halfway down the stairway. There's sort of a platform and a stairway outside the school. And at some point, they looked around, and she was no longer there. And those students continued going towards the subway station and were assaulted shortly thereafter.
Right. Well, bullying expert Barbara Coloroso tells us that bullying is about making the target the other. You know, someone who, for instance, doesn't speak the language well. And we know some of these Asian students, English was not their first language. But what's your sense, having, you know, talked around, that this may be discrimination against Asian students, or is there a sense that, you know, there are bullies who would have found anybody to take this out on, and it's not ethnic.
I don't know how to draw the line, because at the end of the day, some kid is hurt or some kid is bleeding. I don't think there's any question in this case that students were targeted specifically because they were Asian. What the motivation was, I can't speak to. I know Dr. Ackerman, Arlene Ackerman, our superintendent, has said that what happened in Philadelphia was part of a more serious problem of racism in society. And one of the responses to her from the Asian community has been that that may be so, but you still have to keep the kids safe in school.
Yeah. And explain to us, too, how part of this could be an apple cart being upset in this neighborhood. Tell us a little bit. We all feel we may know a little bit about South Philadelphia, a neighborhood with quite a bit of character, but how has it changed over the years?
South Philadelphia has changed dramatically. It's a place where there are still murals of Frank Sinatra and some of the great Italian singers, and there continues to be a strong Italian presence and a Jewish presence. But starting in about 1985, in the post-war Vietnam resettlements, you had large numbers of Vietnamese, Laotian, Cambodian refugees coming into this community, and the transition has been difficult for everyone involved. There is a history of violence against Asians in South Philadelphia. There was a Cambodian man named Hang Lim, who in 1990 was beaten to death in South Philadelphia. You can't say this directly flows from that, but violence against Asians in that neighborhood is not new.
Well, meanwhile, you mentioned there were 10 kids who were suspended. 6 were African-American, 4 were Asian after the attacks. So we'll wait and see what the report says about, you know, where the blame lies. But meanwhile, what's the mood there?
I think the mood at the school, from talking to students and some teachers, is somewhat of a tense truce. The school has taken affirmative steps. They've installed more security cameras. They've added security guards. They've begun diversity training for staff and for students. At the same time, Asian students who I talked to were still concerned about their safety and what might come next.
Meanwhile, the bigger picture, how big a deal is it that the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund has filed a civil rights complaint with the Justice Department?
It's a pretty big deal. The Asian community is really standing up for itself in a way that it, historically it's only recently begun to do in Philadelphia. I think also ALDEF, as it's called, has also won concessions in other parts of the country, particularly in Brooklyn.
What does that mean when they win?
The school is forced to accept reforms in the form of additional training or regulations. So there's a lot that could happen in Philadelphia as a result of that complaint.
That's Jeff Gamage, staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, talking to us about a flare-up in bullying at the school in December. The school district is said to be issuing a report on that any day now. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. My pleasure.
Quick note before the break. As New Orleans gets ready for a big Super Bowl parade tonight, one ad from the game is still creating buzz, the one with David Letterman and Jay Leno grumpily watching together, separated by Oprah Winfrey. On his show last night, David Letterman, who thought up the ad, poked fun at himself.
My mom called me today from Indianapolis, and she watched the Super Bowl, and Mom said, David, who was the guy with Oprah and Jay?
Meanwhile, Jay Leno, who beat out Letterman for Tonight Show host back in 1992 and whose last primetime show is tonight, was more emotional.
Well, I walk in, I see Dave, and he puts his hand and I shake hands. And, you know, whatever happened for the last 18 years disappeared. It was great to see my old friend again. It was wonderful.
Well, they go head-to-head once more on March 1st when Jay Leno moves back to the late-night host of The Tonight Show. And we'll be back in 1 minute, here and now. Best-selling author Amy Bloom was once a practicing psychotherapist, and to this reader, her new collection of short stories sometimes feels like eavesdropping on patients passing through a therapist's office, telling us in a matter-of-fact way how they've become entangled in love.
At 2 o'clock in the morning, no one is to blame. We'd been watching CNN.
One scene of disaster leading to the next, the reporter in front of what might have been a new anthrax outbreak giving way to the military analyst in the studio with new developments in Kabul, when William put his hand on my breast. My husband was asleep upstairs, dreaming of making the deal that would put us on high ground when the entire economy collapsed, and William's wife was asleep in the guest room, getting her restorative 8 hours. I think of Isabel as forcefully regular and elegant in all of her habits, and I'm sure she thinks of me as a little askew in all of mine. William's hand trembled slightly. Our two plain gold wedding bands twinkled in the light of the TV screen. It does not seem possible that we are people with 3 children, 2 marriages, and 110 years between us.
That's Claire describing the beginning of her affair with William, each married to other people, all best friends, and Claire and William are about to destroy that. Then there's the grieving stepmother and stepson mourning the death of the family patriarch who tumble into bed together, destroying the bond they had, creating a new uneasy one. Amy's book is Where the God of Love Hangs Out, 4 short stories, and then 2 sets of short stories that are linked. She joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco with more. Amy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your thoughts on just how it felt to me to read this? It could be a bunch of hooey to you, but I was reminded that you are a psychotherapist, and it just feels like, well, one reviewer said, we're seeing more of your characters' interior lives and the way, you know, let's say their furniture looks, so does that feel to you like the work you once did?
I don't know. Do you have a therapist who knows what your furniture looks like? No. I understand why it's always compelling and interesting to people, and I understand that people think that therapists must know fascinating and unusual things about people, but not really. As Willa Cather said, there are 5 human stories. What's extraordinary is how often they repeat themselves. I think we all pretty much know them. You know, it's your parents, your children, who you loved, who loved you. The end of your life.
Yeah.
It's not a big group. It's a little group. And that's what makes it so hard to write about human beings, which is that you're not going to come up with a new story or a new plot. You're only going to try to find ways with language to tell them differently.
Yeah.
I think that these are pretty much the stories that human beings have inside them that they would tell you if you would only listen.
Yeah. Well, there's the story Permafrost. It's about the relationship between Frances, a hospital social worker, and her patient Beth, who develops a severe case of flesh-eating bacterial disease while she's in the hospital. She loses limbs. And the die would seem cast for the way the rest of the story is going to go. Frances, the strong one who's going to help Beth, Beth the patient, but then Beth flourishes and sort of leaves Frances behind.
I had met somebody, a really nice woman I had met at a dinner party, and then I met her again at another friend's house, and she was lovely. And she was alone, and obviously a little lonely, and as she talked about her life, I just thought, oh, she has just missed the train every single time for the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you do meet people like that. They're lovely, and they're smart, and they have something to offer, and yet they wind up very much alone, very much wishing they weren't alone, and always a little puzzled by life.
Hmm.
And really, I was as interested in writing about her efforts to make her way in the world, even though she understood she was always a step behind.
Hmm. And what about William and Claire? Have you met them? These are the 50-something lovers when we first see them, as we heard. They're beginning their affair as they're, you know, glued to the television post 9/11 while their spouses sleep nearby. She's prickly. He's morbidly obese. They fall in love.
It happens.
Yeah.
It happens that not everybody looks like Brad and Angelina, and that doesn't stop them from falling in love. That love is not convenient and it's not always pretty. And as Camus said, we do not always choose whom we love. In fact, I would say we never choose whom we love.
Yeah. There's another pair of illicit lovers. This is Julia and Lionel. He's the stepson we mentioned, 19, I think, and Julia is how much older than him?
She's about 39.
Right. Lionel's father, Julia's husband, suddenly dies. They are grieving, and they have the brief encounter. It changes their relationship. Do you know these people, or did this also just come from knowing that life hands us stories like this?
I would say that almost all of my characters are essentially feats of imagination. I mean, even the lady who I met at the dinner party, it was more her quality that struck me. I didn't actually know anything about her life. As a writer, I guess you write characters because they have little pieces of you inside of them, and you help them grow, and they become three-dimensional human beings. In general, my characters, not based on people I know, although they're always bits and pieces, and you're always meeting people.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, you also include a poem. It's just there on page 179. It's quoted, a couple of lines are quoted elsewhere in the book, but it's from Jane Hirschfield. When your life looks back, it begins, when your life looks back as it will at itself, at you, what will it say? Just an interesting choice, that poem in between two stories. Why? What does that poem mean to you?
Well, I love Jane's work. I think she's an extraordinary American poet. And I asked her if I could use two of her poems, and she was delighted. She said, you know, it's going to be like coming across a palm tree in the middle of the train station. People are going to go, oh, it's a whole poem. It's not just an epigraph. It's not just a little note. And I said, I know. I said, on the other hand, it's my book. I think I can do what I want. And I happen to think that that poem goes very strongly with some of the stories. The stories are about living your life forward and looking at it backward. That's not the way, of course, for some of the stories that are centered on young people. But I also thought it had a lot to do with the last story, the title story, Where the God of Love Hangs Out, which is both a very young woman and a much older man, daughter and father-in-law, looking at their lives together.
And making admissions to each other that they can't to their spouses. It's very sweet.
I liked it.
By the way, the poem does feel like sort of, I don't know, yeah, a palm tree. Pretty good. I mean, but it was so much fun to come across it. Do you have the book there? Do you mind reading us the last couple stanzas?
No, I really am always pleased and honored to read her work.
Okay.
So this is the poem, When Your Life Looks Back, towards the bottom of the poem. And did you have a choice in this? You did. Sleeping and waking, the horses around you, the mountains around you, the buildings with their tall hydraulic shafts, those of your own kind around you. A few times you stood on your head. A few times you chose not to be frightened. A few times you held another beyond any measure. A few times you found yourself held beyond any measure. Mortal, your life will say, as if tasting something delicious, as if in envy, your immortal life will say this as it is leaving.
That's Amy Bloom reading the last couple of stanzas of Jane Hirschfield's poem, When Your Life Looks Back. It pops up in the middle of Amy's new collection of short stories, which is called Where the God of Love Hangs Out. Amy, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure to talk about it and to read that poem.